Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Disintegration by Michael Butterworth, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We first met one another at university. She was reading psychology, and I was taking a printing diploma at a nearby art college. We both had similar interests and opposite characters. I think that I was the more stable of the two. She was frightened of life and unsure of herself. Her interest in psychology was most probably in part a symptom of her state of mind, for I rarely got the impression that she was studying for the sake of her career. It was a strange choice for her, and it really didn't lead her anywhere except, as I now see, deeper into her own mind. Because of her fear of people, she had no faith in human nature. In the case of 99% of people she met, I would say that she had good cause to suspect their motives towards her. But she could not bring herself to trust even the 1% who were always trustworthy and warm of affection. I fell in love with her, but it took me 6 years of married life to convince her of that fact. We married suddenly, 2 months after we met. I gave up my printing course. She decided to stay on at university. I was a bit irritated at this, though I hid my feelings and encouraged her, in the hope that she would one day come out of her shell and think of her career and her future rather than use, as she did, her psychology course as a tool with which to dwell upon the past. And what a past! She was the product of a dissatisfied marriage, of parents who argued continually, and who looked upon their children as a source of their unhappiness. As she was the most sensitive of the three, she was also the one who grew up most affected by the obvious rift in her parents' relationship and the physical beatings up of her and her mother by her father. We had a succession of flats and eventually a house and children of our own. Her course at the university was completed, though as I suspected she would, she failed the final examination. As, by this time, I had won her over, she was not too upset. She did not attempt to resit the exam, but resigned herself instead to family life with me. All went well for a number of years, until one morning we had a cable sent to us from an old friend, who in the interim had become head of a psychology research center. Neither she nor I had severed relationships with our old friends, and kept ourselves thoroughly up to date with regard to their work. A mound of literature came through our door each week, the outcome of subscriptions to just about every relevant journal on mental research. I suppose that, having exhausted its search for knowledge on the purely physical plane, and succeeding in conquering its birth planet and, also, interstellar space, the human race felt that it was now beneficial to its survival to turn its attention inward, at its origin. There were still so many social and living problems that had to be solved amongst the inhabitants of Earth. Research of this kind, scientific investigation of the previously scorned powers of the human mind, such as telepathy, telekinesis, the power to create, and so on, had become popular. Tom's cable could not have come at a better time for both of us. He was at the peak of a scientific hubbub. It stated briefly, without mixing words, that he needed guinea pigs to take part in a consciousness-swapping experiment. He remembered that she was a particularly susceptible person with an easily opened mind, ideally suited. Because he could think of absolutely no one else, he had been forced to turn to us despite our family ties. We both agreed to help him, a rather foolish decision, I now admit. At the time, however, we were blinded by an altruistic feeling of desire to martyr ourselves for the sake of scientific advancement. We had some guilty feelings about leaving our children, but we reasoned, the research would not take more than a few weeks at most, and we would soon return. We left our children in care of an aunt, paid off a few months' mortgage repayments on the house, and left at once, all expenses paid by courtesy of the Lockwood Psychology Research Foundation. Tom, Dr. Thomas Brown, is a fat, perspiring man, very patient and dedicated. As is the case with many research scientists that I have met, he has cultivated a kind of dual character. On one hand, he is humane and considerate. On the other, he is a ruthless exploiter. An ideal formula for a man who has both family and self-survival interest at heart. But in Tom, the instinct to survive, sublimated nowadays as the exploration of inner space rather than geographical investigation of the unknown, has gained the upper hand. Although he likes to be responsible, his thirst for knowledge causes him to have a unique morality unparalleled in any other person I have known, except perhaps in the monstrous scientist of old horror movies who used fellow humans in the performance of some cruel experiment or other. Odd as it may seem, despite his great intelligence, I don't think he is consciously aware of this. As is the case with many such professional men, the subject's compliance is regarded as pure good-naturedness. It does not occur to him that the subject is unaware of danger, that her enthusiasm may be the enthusiasm of the naive, well-intentioned but foolhardy. It was with this sort of well-intentioned blinkeredness, I am sure, that Tom accepted our decision to help. He received us well and entertained us with dinners, drinks, and stories. For much of the time, as it would be with three enthusiasts keen to explore the human mind, our conversation was about psychology, the people in the field, and the discoveries being made. It was pretty evident that he thought his foundation was on to a pretty shattering breakthrough. The idea, he eventually confided in us, had enraptured him throughout his adult life. A world in which mental communication could become an everyday reality. It was not only his vision. Communication of the sort he envisioned had always been a preoccupation, but Tom had been especially haunted by the idea, and the situation as we found it at his institution was that, after years of study as a student, and after further years of postgraduate research, and then as a professor, his team had designed an apparatus he was confident could freely transmit thought from one human being to another. As yet, a thought could be transmitted no great distance, only the length of a piece of cable. In order to receive and transmit it all, the brains of two participants had to be attached by cable to the apparatus, one transmitting his thoughts into the apparatus, the other receiving the same thoughts from it. In effect, the apparatus was a media device, and although a block in the development of instantaneous communication, telepathy, nevertheless, it was a first step in that direction. It was the first stage, and Tom was both proud and excited. We were shown the apparatus, and a date was fixed for the experiment. Because of the numerous test conditions that had to be right before the main experiment could take place, we were, in the meantime, kept busy performing tests, both on ourselves and on the apparatus. One of the tests, I remember, was arranged to determine the speed of flow of our thoughts. Another determined the clarity of our thinking. In order to try out the equipment, a one-word thought of mine was successfully transmitted to Helen, and vice versa. Tom had told us that actual thought transference, once considered a remarkable achievement in itself, was accomplished daily by his laboratory staff, and was only used now as a test. What Tom was after was the transference of one entire mind into the mind of another, in the hope of setting off a correspondence. He was working on the assumption that the computation of one single thought could be the mathematical basis for the transference of an entire matrix. The calculation would be long and complicated, but he was confident of success. The day arrived at last. We had been waiting in nervous anticipation of this moment. Helen was wired up first, then I. There were no electrodes, only a sheet of what Tom called thought-sensitive material, which was fitted to the inside of a rubber cap. This cap was tailored to cover the whole head, neck, chest, and back. The only inlet was an air pipe which fed our noses. From her headpiece, a maze of colored wires led into a row of input sockets on the instrument. I say instrument. In fact, the apparatus was composed of many instruments, so voluminous that they more or less filled our sizable laboratory. For the idea at first was to transfer her mind into mine. My headpiece was thus attached by wires to a row of output sockets. After a while, Tom told us, it would be possible, by throwing a switch, to reverse the flow. My mind in her body, her mind in my body. The third stage of the experiment, and the highlight, would be the evacuation of both our minds from our bodies. Our separate minds would be stored in separate banks of the computer, and he hoped we would be allowed to communicate at a speed approaching that of thought. Finally, our minds would be returned to our bodies, the computer's memory having recorded every detail of the encounter of minds. Some hours were spent by technicians fiddling with bits of the apparatus in order to stabilize conditions. Then Tom gave the order to commence. Juice was turned on, and I began to feel the familiar tingling in my brain cells that had characterized early experiments when we were being engaged in the transference of single thoughts. Then, without warning, my senses were cut off, an entirely new experience. I could not see, hear, feel, taste, or touch. My first reaction was to panic, but as the state was not altogether uncomfortable, in fact it was quite pleasant, I soon calmed down. It was a bit like being in a sleep state, where, identically, the five senses are curtailed. But by contrast, I retained awareness. Not the familiar awareness of my five known senses, but presumably that of my mystical sixth sense. My psychic state also differed from my normal sleep state in that I experienced no dreaming, though I felt that, had the dream imagery come to me, I could easily have controlled it. This was a pleasant feeling, for I have long desired to be able to control my dreams. There were no images, only void. I could not sense the particles which made up my new body. I knew I was, and that I was there, and that was all. The condition did not alarm me, nor was it boring. I felt contented. After a while, I became conscious of an approaching something, which I assumed must be Helen. A moment later, her consciousness had merged with mine. Hers was quite different to my own, and its approach had filled me with anxiety. I realized why as soon as we became one mind. She was frightened, and could not succumb to the relaxation that had overcome me. She was full of spikes and filled me with gaps. No words were exchanged, only feelings. By conveying to her a feeling of protection, I was able to calm her somewhat. A great part of her fright was dispelled at having found something to hide in. She had hardly had time to pulse more than a wave or so of her sweet feelings of gratitude into me, when I felt myself suddenly grow distant from her. I found myself in an area much the same as the first had been, before she had joined me, and assumed that Tom had now transferred my mind into her unoccupied brain. I felt pleasure, for the experiment was progressing well, and the second stage was almost over. But I was concerned for my partner, and hoped that by now she had overcome her fears. But she had not, and I think that it was possibly her resistance to the whole affair that brought about her fate. Tom, absorbed by the manipulation of our minds, had neglected to provide us with any means of communication with the world he inhabited. she could not protest. She had been moved pawn-like to an area identical with mine, but separate from it. I was made aware of this fact by her extremely clear thoughts that pierced through the void like needles. On this occasion, no doubt, because of our detachment from one another, our thoughts were transmitted in the forms of words and pictures, as well as feelings. She was still in a state of panic, but having realized that I was close by, and that so far there had been no catastrophe, she communicated with greater objectivity. She told me that it had been silly of her to behave the way she had, and of how lost she had felt when Tom had suddenly taken me from her. What she said sounded ridiculous. I laughed, for the picture that her words invoked in me was one of Tom and I having an affair. Part of me knew that this interpretation was not what she had meant, and perfectly understood her real meaning. But it seemed to me that this sort of punning and literal acceptance of words was acceptable to both of us, even desirable. I had a tendency to want to break down the conditioning power of words, which I saw as invented tools that only partially did their job of controlling communicated true feeling. She must have agreed with me, for a moment later she laughed. After we had made a pact not to use words except for the conveyance of specific information, we each settled down to our own place, meaning to become intimately attached. The area between us was a sharp barrier, separating us by what seemed infinity, which was an actual fact only a few computer banks. Living in this mental limbo was an existence uncomplicated by quantified physical measurements of space, matter, and time. For the three elements did not exist in quite the same way as they appeared to exist to us out here in the five-sense world. There was not much time to spend together before I was suddenly made conscious of the fact that communication from her had ceased. That moment was the worst I had experienced in my life. There was a sort of explosion of images from her, in which her mind was completely open and laid bare. Her entire life's experiences came out, a human wreckage that floated in pieces through my existence. Instantly, I knew everything about her, who she was, and why she was. My understanding of her as a person gained over long years of marriage was nothing compared with the intensity with which I knew her in that single instant. The frail, unworkable structure she had given her mind, with the desperate intention to stave off the cruelties of life, had collapsed. The grim determination she had used to hold it all together was dissipated. Then, as quickly, every trace of her mind was gone, melted like overnight snow. There was no question of her merely having stopped communicating. She had gone. Simultaneously, I received a terrible pain that burst explosively from my center and then spread outward towards my extremities. I endured this for a split second, then I awoke. Images of the laboratory were swimming before my eyes, jumbled and incoherent. My hand was pressed against my head to ease the pain, which had somehow concentrated there. Tom's face came into my field of vision. Someone pulled down my arms, and my headpiece was removed. I lost consciousness and awoke in bed in the Foundation's sick room. Later, Tom came in to inform me that she was dead. That's really where the story ends, except to say that the news that Tom brought to me was already old in my head. I had experienced her death alongside her. After making arrangements for her disintegration, I left with a bad headache and one or two other ailments that come and go, symptoms that Tom assures me will clear up gradually over a period of years. Not much comfort. And she was right, my listener interrupted. Tom had taken you away from her? Yes. Only not in the manner we had thought, ironically. There's been no affair. I managed a sardonic laugh. I view it all as a scientific experiment, perhaps a very good one, that went wrong. Tom was as white as death, the most upset man I have seen. He was 90% directly responsible for her death. My listener drew me to her. I let her cradle me, but I could feel no emotion of the kind she might have expected me to have. My mind was still too much preoccupied with thoughts of unfaithfulness. I lay stiffly against her breast. Whether she realized my dilemma or not, I could not say, but a moment later she let me go. I arose and rescued my drink from the bar top, where I had left it half an hour ago. Hoaxer by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. Jerry was satisfied with the upload complete. This one was bound to get a million views instantly. He was getting better at the work he did. Every video or photo he produced was more convincing than the last. Lately, this hobby of his had been developing rapidly. He'd even bought some fancy photo equipment so that all of the content that he used would be original and more difficult to call out. He had definitely moved outside of the realm of shaky camcorder footage and Polaroids of thrown hubcaps. As he anticipated, the new video went viral within a matter of days. Jerry took great pleasure in reading and laughing about the comments that were left on the video. This kind of material tended to polarize people greatly. Either they were terribly excited or they were incredibly agitated. Either way, people loved to chime in and add their two cents. Every now and then there was a worthwhile comment, but for the most part they were made by senseless believers or overly harsh critics. The ones he enjoyed the most were the ones that could correctly deduce how he had pulled off whatever particular hoax in that week's video. Whether people believed them or not did not matter to him. His main motivation was the monetization of his channel and achieving the most views possible. Someday, Jerry hoped that he would be able to make a living with these films, or if he was really lucky, get a job doing special effects in Hollywood. For now, he was happy to have an enjoyable hobby that brought in a little money. Jerry didn't like to admit it, but he also did it for the attention. Somehow, the views, the comments, the anger, and false beliefs, even though they were not directed towards him, felt like a validation of his efforts. He really did want to believe that there was other life in the universe. Partly it was this desire that compelled him to fake it, to give people hope, or to just keep them talking about the subject. Sometimes, Jerry wondered if anyone could really take it all seriously. There were many others like him. The internet had provided a lush breeding ground for all types of hoaxers. Most of them fed off each other using circular evidence that ended up citing itself as authority. One day, Jerry hoped that he would be able to construct a video so convincing that a large amount of the public would actually believe it. A video that would make alien autopsy seem like more of a childish joke than it already did. One which would become a household name, like that of the Roswell crash. On the freeway, stuck in traffic, Jerry thought about how much he didn't like his job. He wasted his skills on customer service, but he had gone to public school, and that's what he had been trained for. He figured that by now, he was good enough with design programs and his camera equipment to go into it professionally. But many of his generation had already had the same idea, and graphic designers were a dime a dozen. Not being able to find anything on the radio, he hit his fist against the steering wheel. How many hours of his life had he spent on this damn freeway? Perhaps tonight he should take a different way home, to change up the monotony. After work, instead of taking his usual route, he decided to drive up to the mountains. His camera equipment was in the car, and he figured he could do some nighttime time-lapse photos.
He headed up the 2 freeway towards the mountains, got a bite to eat and a couple of beers to drink while he sat up throughout the night. When he found a nice spot that seemed like it would be really dark, he opened a beer and set up his equipment. It was going to be nice to spend a night out in the dark and away from the city. He was going to have to do this more often. Around 3 o'clock, he woke up. He must have drifted off during the night. He'd been working on a particularly long time-lapse shot and dozed off. The shot was most likely ruined. Cursing, he went about setting up the camera equipment for another shot. It took his eyes a minute to adjust to the dark after turning off the flashlight. When they did, he hardly had time to click off a picture. Fortunately, the video camera had been rolling the whole time. His breath caught in his throat as he looked into the sky and saw 2 shapes blotting out the stars. As they came closer, he realized they were not 2 shapes, but 1. Almost like 2 hang gliders connected with a latticework of bars. The thing in the sky made a horrible high-pitched, piercing tone. It was impossible to tell its distance until it set down right in front of him. Only now did he breathe. He checked to make sure the film was still rolling, and was able to snap off a few more shots before the craft began glowing dark, oxidized purple. A loud click snapped through the air and gave off a sulfur smell momentarily. The sound seemed to trigger the craft to unfold in reverse origami fashion. Like beautiful ribbons, the craft unfurled before him, shrouded by aurora. 2 iridescent gelatinous squares emerged floating from the center of the now open craft and rose above the ship that sat like a glowing metallic flower. The squares hovered in the air as if they were jellyfish in a tank, quivering with rolling waves through their surfaces. As the creatures moved, their bodies gave off marvelous and unbearable symphonic utterances. He knew they were speaking to him, but the music of their language was impossible to take in without losing one's mind. He was drawn toward madness as the volume of their language music intensified along with its tempo. He understood none of it, except for the feeling that they knew no communication would be possible. With this epiphany, the creatures seized their liquid vibrating and folded themselves back into the ship. If it were not for the film and photographs, Jerry would not have believed what had happened to him, even though it was something that he had longed for all his life. The music language still played on loop in his mind, and his confusion surrounding the encounter did as well. He needed to sleep on it, but at the same time, he knew that he would need to record his testimony while still fresh. As soon as he arrived home, frightened as he was, he pulled out his handheld recorder and recorded his account of what had happened. He made sure to back up the footage and photographs on several hard drives, but was afraid to put it on the cloud. He wished that he had a friend to call and tell about what had just happened. Instead, he would probably surf the web to see if anyone else had had a similar experience. Jerry's first inclination was to add the spectacular footage to his YouTube channel. Immediately, he realized that this would be a terrible mistake. After all, everything on the channel was falsified, and most intelligent people knew so. No, he could not put it up on the channel, for what he had now was real and deserved better. Perhaps he could start a new channel. He had to share his experience with the world somehow. There had to be a way to get this information into the right hands. For all of his thinking about alien encounters, he had never once considered what he would do if it really happened. He remembered reading about an organization that apparently did valid studies into supernatural phenomena. He looked up their contact info and sent an email to the head of their department for UFO studies. Straight away, the email bounced back to his inbox with a notification that he had been blocked as a sender. Shocked, he decided to call their office to make his report directly.
Oh yes, we've heard of you. We know all about your hoaxes and do not need people like you interfering with our legitimate work, making things more difficult and convoluted in the public eye,
said the voice on the other end of the line. He sat down the receiver in a state of disbelief. All he ever wanted to do was arouse people's interest. Now, he had experienced the most insane event of his life, and he was also finding out that he was notorious for his playful hoaxes. Not only that, but his hobby was now interfering with his ability to share his immensely profound and otherworldly experience. Who was he supposed to go to now? Would the police listen to such details? Even though he had the footage to back himself up, he doubted it. Perhaps the best route would be to make as many copies of the footage as possible, and to distribute it as widely as he could. He did see one flaw in this method, though. The problem was one of deterioration. He knew that the footage would end up being copied repeatedly and downsampled to the point where it would not be believable. He had to find a credible organization that would help him spread his evidence. But there was no way of knowing when reaching out to such organizations if his reputation preceded him. Even if he took down all of his previous hoaxes, it might be too late to regain his tarnished name. Perhaps he would be able to find a documentary filmmaker that would jump on the opportunity to turn his evidence into a spectacular and convincing film. Agitated and upset, Jerry decided to delete his channel and his blog. His heart sank for a moment when he hit the button that would remove them forever. He had spent so much time and energy on these sites, and he had earned a decent amount of money. Now, with one click, it was over. Hopefully from here out, his past playfulness would no longer interfere with his hard evidence. Still, he had nowhere to go with the evidence. He didn't even know where to start now that he knew that his name had been tarnished. After a long think on it, Jerry came to the conclusion that there was only one way to deal with the problem. He would have to start acting more like a scientist and less like a filmmaker. If no one was going to believe his footage and pictures, then he would have to go out and get more. No one could deny reproducible evidence. The only problem was whether or not his friends would be returning. It was a big if, but now he had a plan, and this time he was going to make sure that the proof was undeniable. It was no trouble clearing out his savings at the camera store. He'd always wanted to do this, but had never had any justification to do so. When he saw the grand total at the register, he had a moment of panic. Holding his breath, he swiped his card and the commitment was made. Now he was armed with an array of video cameras, an infrared camera, and sensors for all of them to start rolling with any sign of motion. With the new equipment, he would be able to capture the aliens from every angle except from above. This detail bothered him, so he decided to coordinate his trip with the time that the Google Earth satellite would be passing over the area. Hopefully it wouldn't be a cloudy night. With his gear ready and a date picked to spend another night in the mountains, all the cards were in place. All except the variable of whether or not the creatures from another world would return. The day arrived, and Jerry called in sick to work. He wanted to get to the mountains as early as possible, find the spot where he had been, and set up the equipment with enough time left to do some systems checks. Before leaving, he viewed the tapes of the first encounter, hoping to find anything useful and to pinpoint exactly where he had been set up before. All through the drive into the mountains, he was giddy with excitement, as if he was heading into the most important moment of his life. He prayed to himself that they would show up, and that his investment in the equipment would pay off. Finding what seemed to be the exact spot, or at least as close to it as possible, Jerry parked his car and began to unload his photographic equipment. He set up a large circle of video cameras, hoping to capture the event from multiple angles, making it impossible to debunk. He also set up the infrared camera and an audio recorder, wanting to have every possible piece of info and evidence to back up his story. This time he brought no beer. He wanted to be of sound mind, and wanted nothing to interfere with his credibility. Running a final check on the cameras and recorder, he found that everything was in working order, including the motion sensors. A few test pictures proved that if they showed up, he would be able to produce a stunning reproduction of the event. The sun set, and with it, Jerry's excitement grew. Several hours into waiting, his enthusiasm began to wane. He had known all along that coming back up here was a long shot, but his high hopes had made him optimistic. Now, the reality that it might not happen started to sink in. He'd taken quite a gamble on buying the equipment, and since he was using it, it could not be returned. Reminding himself to be patient, he focused on his breathing and decided that either way he should enjoy being up here beneath the big, beautiful sky. Taking out his binoculars, he resolved to scan the heavens. So many stars, so many other suns. They had to be out there somewhere. Jerry's anticipation quickly exploded into nervousness as the strange, folded shape from his past encounter descended from the night sky. Quickly, he started snapping pictures and checking if the video cameras were rolling. This time, he was prepared, and he was going to have tons of high-definition footage to prove it. The craft set down within the circle of his cameras, proving that luck was on his side. After the seemingly impossible unfolding of the craft, the two living squares emerged once again, dramatized by their incomprehensible symphonic language. And Jerry was catching it all on tape. Not only was it one of the most profound moments he had experienced, but now he knew people would have to take him seriously. He realized he was shouting in excitement. A flurry of sound swept through the air, filling it with sweet, inhuman music. The liquid-like jelly of the squares straddled the air above their craft as they spoke to each other.
What is that horrible noise that it is making? It's not even close to being tonal. What a racket.
We have an audio feed connected to the craft. Let's leave it for later.
It may be trying to communicate with us. Do you think that that might be important?
We have no way of knowing that. Besides, you know that's not what we are here for. Just start recording. We need this from as many angles as we can get, and try scanning it in different wavelengths. We may not get this opportunity again. We're lucky to be having it for a second time, and if we don't treat this encounter like scientists, others are bound to think it is just another one of our hoaxes.
In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Disintegration by Michael Butterworth, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, and Hoaxer by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Lesko. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Paperback Science Fiction Anthology. Available at spacecowboybooks.com and lulu.com. Be sure to visit us at our store in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And connect with us on Instagram or Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the program.